You're listening to the FQXI podcast. Welcome to a special edition of the Foundational Questions Institute podcast on science and creativity. I'm Zia Morali. In August, FQXI held its fifth international meeting in Banff, Alberta. My regular podcast co-host, Brendan Foster, and I were lucky enough to sit down with some of the other conference participants and chat through the interplay between science, fiction, art, and music. As you'll hear, the conversation was pretty informal, with different people dropping in and out of the discussion at various points. Joining Brendan and me at the start were best-selling science fiction author Neil Stevenson, artist Jane Tollickson, who recently ran a physics art workshop at the Perimeter Institute and has a profound interest in music and jazz, and quantum physicist, and a musician with his own band, Ian Durham, whom regular listeners will recognise as an old friend of the podcast. Later during the chat, we're also joined by cosmologist and saxophonist Stefan Alexander, who recently published the book The Jazz of Physics. I should mention that Brendan is also an accomplished musician who, with his former bandmates, composed and performed the title music for this very podcast, so I'm in excellent company. Over the course of our chat, we'll be discussing the parallels between creating art, music and science, the role of improvisation, the vital and often overlooked importance of making mistakes in any creative and scientific endeavour, and ways to change how science is taught long term. We kicked off with Neil Stevenson, whose latest novel, Seven Eves, describes the aftermath of the disintegration of the moon. I noted that Stevenson's writing is widely admired among FQXI's members, not just because of his ability to spin a good yarn, but also because, over the course of his writing career, he has shown that he takes science fact extremely seriously. So, I began by asking him how he comes up with his ideas, and how important it is to take inspiration from real science.
Before I start, thank you for those very kind words about my books. I come from a sort of background in a scientific and engineering family, and so that helps. I guess my general answer is that when you're doing creative work of any kind, it's not just a matter of just making a bunch of stuff up. Particularly if you're trying to tell a coherent story in a novel, let's say, there needs to be some kind of discipline that brings those ideas together into something that's coherent and that strikes the reader as making sense. Readers have a pretty finely tuned feel for when something isn't hanging together logically. If you drape a story over a kind of background of engineering or science, you get a lot of that for free. And in addition, you get more ideas than you might have come up with just sitting alone, trying to sit around and be, quote, creative, unquote. Because there are all kinds of surprises in science, unexpected complications that come up, say, in an engineering project, that if you embrace those and work them into the story and pose them as challenges or as surprises for your characters, it's possible to come up with a better yarn and more interesting characters than you might have done if you were just kind of free associating.
And so, you know, one of your last books talked about the disintegration of the moon. How do these ideas come to you?
Well, that one was a huge exaggeration of, it's not very scientific, I should say this, but it was based on some actual research that was done about the problem of orbital debris, of sort of space junk, old discarded satellites and rocket boosters that are floating around in low Earth orbit. And the concern has been raised that every time two of these things just happen to bang into each other, they fragment and make more smaller fragments. And as the number of fragments increases, so does the probability that any two of them will hit each other and make more fragments yet. And the specter has been raised that if this went into a kind of exponential growth, we could end up with so many tiny bits of junk in low Earth orbit that it would make it basically impossible for us to go into space as we're accustomed to. And so all I did in the case of Seven Eves, which is the book you're referring to, was to take that idea and make it really, really big. by having the source of all the pieces of junk be a fragmentation of the moon.
Okay, well, you know, we've talked with Neil about how his science fiction does have to be grounded in science for it to be taken seriously, although he kind of gave that caveat that his last book was quite a wild idea. What about actually doing physics? So we have Ian Durham, that listeners to the FQXI podcast will know very, very well, but may not know that as well as being a physicist, he's also a member of a band. Let me ask you, physics often has the image of being something that's very logical, that's very mathematical. It's a list of facts, it's very dry. But can you talk about how you go about thinking about your ideas and your research, and how do you bring creativity into your research?
So I fundamentally came from a very creative family. So my dad is a retired high school English teacher who is very active in theater. My mom is a retired high school French teacher and professional artist who's also involved in theater. They kind of roll their eyes when I tell them what I'm doing. And I take a very creative approach to physics. I think physics is phenomenally creative. It requires the same sort of thinking that art creates. The same sort of juices that fuel my creative side fuel my physics side. And I like to say that I never got out of the why stage. So if you have kids, you know that little kids just constantly ask why. Well, that's me. I never got out of that stage, and I just keep asking why, and I've never been satisfied with any answers I've gotten, so I keep asking why. And I think that is a trait that is both of physicists and other scientists, as well as I think many artists ask that same sort of thing. That's really what drives me and how I work.
Okay, so we've got an artist here and we've got three musicians. I should say that Neil Stevenson has crept away because he had another appointment. So don't worry that you don't hear anything more from him in the podcast. But Stefan Alexander has now walked in. And of course, I should say, because Brendan's looking over at me, that he is also a member of a band. And you may or may not know this, but his former band is responsible for the FQXI podcast theme tune. Maybe I should hand over the mic to Brendan, who is a musician, because he might be able to ask more pertinent questions. Or maybe just give your own insight into, you know, music and physics, Brendan. And I know that Stefan is itching to talk about that as well.
Yeah, thanks, Sia. Okay, here's a question for you. When I used to do physics, I often found that I had the same feeling in my head when you, say, do a derivative or you take some, you know, you solve some equations, and there's this feeling in your head where it's like, yeah, that's right, it sort of feels right. And I get the same feeling when I listen to music or play music, and you sort of feel like, ah, that's the right note, or that's when the beat is right, you kind of, I don't know, you feel that way, Stefan, like the same, you have the same feeling in your head or not, or if it's totally different.
I totally agree with that. That feeling of rightness, I call it resonance, I know, and I use that word metaphorically. This feeling of rightness, you know, in terms of music sounding right, or you have an idea and it feels right, even before you do the calculation, I think is at the core. In my case, you know, I'm a jazz musician. I come from a musical family, and I've played the saxophone longer than I've done physics. So, I grew up in New York City, started playing and hanging out in the jazz clubs from the time I was 15 years old. So I had more of an advantage, I would say, educationally, to pursue that path than I did with physics, because I grew up in the Bronx in the public school system, and you know, one could argue that the chances of me making it as a professional physicist was not as great. I actually think that, and in the case of, I guess we'll talk about my book in a second, the case that I tried to make in that book is that we'd be surprised about these environments that we find ourselves in that lend themselves to what I call improvisational thinking. So I grew up around people that were guys that were rapping on the street, creating, you know, rhymes in real time. You know, the jazz musicians who are feeling right in the moment about what they're playing without really analyzing theoretically whether or not they're playing within the chord changes, let's say.
I can see Jane Tollickson is nodding away there very emphatically, and I know that you have an interesting relationship with jazz yourself in sort of your history. So maybe you could tell us a bit about that.
Well, my relationship to the jazz world is I became a very close friend of Duke Ellington's sister, Ruth Ellington. She invited me to live with her in New York, and the first night we met, we just totally loved each other, and her niece brought me to the Thanksgiving dinner at her house, which was on Madison Avenue in New York. Mm-hmm. And the last thing I thought was going to happen was I was going to develop this incredibly bonded relationship with Ruth, who was an amazing, amazing character herself, who studied genetics at Columbia University. Mm-hmm. She didn't have a musical background, but Duke, of course, was one of the greatest musical geniuses of all time, so one of the great American composers. So even when I was a teenager, I used to kind of sneak over the border of Connecticut into New York, where the drinking age was lower, and we'd go to jazz clubs, and we'd go to the Five Spot, where we would hear Charlie Mingus play, and where we would hear Thelonious Monk, and the most incredible jazz musicians of the time. I remember we'd sit at the bar with Charlie Mingus, because Charlie really loved to eat as well as create music, and he would have a meal between every single set, and then he would sit with us at the bar and talk to us, because we were these kids, literally, you know, exploring jazz, which he found to be a very interesting phenomena. He was a really great guy, and Coleman Hawkins and Eric Dolphy and Coltrane, and the list goes on and on about the connection. And then being with Ruth and going out with her every night to different clubs where people were playing jazz, or she would have a soiree in her apartment and invite all these people in to perform. She had a baby grand piano in her apartment. Just connecting to the world of improvisation. What I loved about jazz was that it was so creative, because jazz musicians improvised. And in classical music, actually, I was a trained singer, a lyric soprano. And singing, definitely the structure is not to be tampered with unless you're Bach. Jazz was so free and creative and improvised. And then also the great masters of sitar and Indian music, they also did improvisation, and they would intuit, when they would play before an audience, they would intuit the actual frequencies they wanted to work with depending upon their relationship to the audience. So, and it was never a performance with a beginning or an end, it was a continuum. And I thought, how interesting, I love that idea that you were co-creating music with your audience, and that it was an ongoing process.
Since you've brought up this idea about improvisation, Stefan, you mentioned your book, which was The Physics of Jazz, and I think... The Jazz of Physics. And, you know, there's this issue of improvisation, and we've been talking about it in terms of music. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about it a little bit in terms of your physics? Because, you know, I was saying earlier on, I don't think people generally outside of physics think about the mathematical sciences in that way, or any of the sciences in that way, actually.
Yeah. Well, thanks for asking that question. So the title of my book is The Jazz of Physics, and the subtitle is The Secret Link Between Music and the Structure of the Universe. So I'm a theoretical cosmologist, and I work at the interface of string theory and other theories of quantum gravity and cosmology. And so what I do is it can be very mathematical. And as I was writing this book, I was, of course, searching for, like, this connection, for, like, what is this link between, like, you know, physics, fundamental physics in this case, and music, and in particular the music, jazz improvisation. And I didn't realize that right under my nose was what my colleagues, at least the colleagues that I work closely with, and some of them are, like, you know, and they're highlighted in the book, some of the masters of theoretical physics, Chris Isham, Michael Peskin, Robert Brandenburg, these are some of my men, Leon Cooper. And what I found was what we did when we were collaborating on a project, we were working on something unknown, the following thing would happen. Someone would maybe come up with some crazy idea in real time, so it's like a real-time creation. And they'll throw this crazy idea out to the other group. So it's sort of like a group improvisation. So what happens in jazz with a group improvisation? You have someone that's soloing over a particular structure. Let's talk about the blues. A 12-bar blues, 4 beats per bar, and that pattern repeats itself. And so what happens is that the rhythm section, the bass, the drum, you know, and the harmony, will support, right, will create that structure so that the soloist can create, can improvise something. So there's a support for the improvisation. Well, likewise, in my collaborations with, again, this is theoretical physics, right? In those collaborations, what I found was someone would have an idea. The rest of the group, right, would take this idea, no matter how silly the idea was, and they would react to that idea in real time and support that idea by maybe transforming the idea into something else, and they would throw it back at you. That's like group improvisation. Right? And then, and so a lot of it also relied on willfully sometimes making mistakes, the importance of making mistakes. So I had a great teacher. I paid him like $100 an hour, and he gave me a pattern to practice. He said, I just wanted to practice this thing. I said, I gave you $100 for like a 5-note pattern. He goes, yeah, you are to just get this under your finger in all 12 keys. Don't even think about it. I said, well, what the heck are you talking about, man? He goes, and this guy, I don't want to drop name drop who this guy is, a very famous jazz musician. His name is Ornette Coleman, okay? And he said to me the following thing. He said, this music is like being an acrobat. It's not about playing this ideal right note, what have you. It's about that you will make a mistake. In real-time improvisation, you have to accept and surrender to the fact that you're gonna make a mistake. But the art is like being a great acrobat. You have to learn how to fall. So by getting the stuff under your finger, the practice is about learning how to elegantly fall. And this, I think, is a very important thing I try to even get across to my students now, in research, that is, which is, it is very important that we embrace making mistakes, right? And it's the art of what we do with the mistakes and how we support each other and transform that mistake. It's also at the heart of this improvisation. I think at the heart of what Albert Einstein did, at the heart of what Richard Feynman was trying to say, because, you know, it is about that, and not just about being rote, like, you know, being all the time mathematically correct and, you know, being right at the same, you know, that kind of type of stuff.
That's a hugely important point, I think, just because from my own experience when I was teaching students, I think we lost a lot of good physics students who, you know, they hit up against an obstacle when they get something wrong and they've been at school, they've been the top of their class, and they just don't know how to handle getting something wrong. And they think that they're stupid, they think that they're bad, they think that physics is too hard, and they drop out.
And that's the thing, like a lot of students, you know, like, and people in general, they're horrified that if they say something in front of other people, they'll be judged. And so I think it's very important that we create environments. And jazz was that tradition, that Minton's Playhouse was all about that when bebop was being created in the 40s. I mean, those were mistakes that were made, dropping bombs on the kick, the, you know, high harmonics. These were all explorations. They were mistakes that were later on embraced because it sounded right, right? But unless you're exploring that direction, then what chance are you going to have of, like, finding something interesting?
Okay, well, you know, we have Jane Tollickson, who is a very accomplished artist who has been working with physicists on a physics art workshop at the Perimeter Institute. And I think, you know, the physicists here would be interested to know about that and how that might have enhanced, I guess, physicists thinking mathematically.
I'd like to give you a little bit of background of my destiny with physics. My great-granduncle was the founder of Yeshiva University, and the first physics department there was Yekira Ronoff, Lenny Susskind, David Finkelstein. And my granduncle dialogued with Einstein on his belief in God when he was accused of being an atheist, and they published it in the New York Times. And so there was bound to be some relationship between art and physics. I started as an artist. I was the only person in my family that really dabbled in working in the visual realm of art. And so I had, I feel like, this destiny and this, I was drawn to physics, which seemed at the time something that I would never expect to happen. And I married a quantum physicist, Jeff Tollickson, who's the co-director with Yukira Ronoff for the Institute for Quantum Studies at Chapman University. And I've been kind of brought up on weak values and the whole quantum world. And I had this tremendous interest in it philosophically, because I believe that the creativity that quantum theoretical physicists employed in making discoveries was similar to the way I was taught to make discoveries in art. And that basically, Yukira Ronoff, when we were at Perimeter for a month in June, he asked our group to try to develop a new thought experiment that would inspire truer levels of intuition, to discover new mind theories that would be free from the limitation of the math. He felt you couldn't make a new discovery based on what you had done in the past. Of course, he was a protege of David Bohm, and David Bohm, of course, in his views on creativity, felt the same way. He really felt that you had to work intuitively and that you had to work in a wholeness, not a fragmentation, not the ego-individuated way that artists work, because he felt that would only lead to mediocrity, not genius. So there was a need to transcend. There had to be holism in your approach to the creative process. And of course, Aronoff, their latest discovery that they made with the pigeonhole theory and cosmic connectivity, where they find such deep levels of holism in nature and in the universe, that every particle in the universe is connected to every other without entanglement, was totally amazing to me, because this was this unity, this oneness that Bohm talked about in his creativity. And so I decided to take it on. I was at this conference with 45 physicists, and I decided to do a new thought experiment with them, and we would co-create a work of art together and stimulate each other's creative process. Now, we had no idea how this was going to turn out, because it had never been done before. Usually when an artist works with a physicist, they're illustrating a theory, but it's not a real collaboration, co-creation, where they're simultaneously being the observer and the observed at the same time and switching roles completely throughout the whole process. And so what happened was, at Perimeter, there's chalkboards everywhere, and people are putting their formulas on chalkboards and theories and even doing creative work with colored chalks on the chalkboard. So I decided to use the Perimeter approach, and that's why I call it the Perimeter experiment, and simulate a chalkboard. So I got a giant drawing board, and then I put black paper on it, like the black chalkboards, and colored pastels, and I had people sit for me. People had to agree that they wanted to participate in this experiment and that we were co-creating it. So we were always in perfect agreement or joint mind attention through the whole process. And we knew we were going to create a meta representation.
Yeah, could you tell us more about some of the specific physicists who worked with you and what they did for the project?
Well, Yukira Ronoff was a participant. Neil Torek was a participant, the director of Perimeter Institute. Sandu Propescu was one of the participants. Rob Speckin, Tony Luggett.
So Brendan's too polite to ask you this, but I'm going to say, were these pieces actually any good? You know, did the physicists actually produce something that people would want to look at? And how much of it was them creating things? How much of it was you? How much help were you giving them? How much was coming from them?
Well, Gilles Bessard, who, of course, is known for his theory of teleportation, got so excited about the project that he actually designed a whole new visual expression for his teleportation formula, and he put the whole design, I did a life-size portrait of him, and he put it on his t-shirt across his chest, and he, you know, he signed it, and I signed it, and he got so into it, and Gilles, he was like on the floor upside down because it was so big, and he was writing and drawing, and I said, oh my God, you got in it with such passion, and it came out beautiful. And what we would agree with when we worked with everyone is I would ask them which color. For instance, I use a color field, so I would say, well, what color do you feel you can relate to? And they would choose that, so that was their part of doing it. And that was very important because it was all at like black and one color field, the majority of them. And it created, if you could see it, it was like the color would pop out like light. Instead of color, it would be light emanating from the black background. And so it had an illuminating quality. And then they would sit, and I pose them so I can see what part of their face would reveal the most, that I thought was the most character. But when it came to their hands, they made a decision of what they wanted to do with their hands. And I would draw the portrait first. And then we would talk about creative process. And the agreement was that this was joint mind attention, that the subject was not passive. They were active in relaying an inner laboratory in this experiment. And we were communing back and forth without a self-consciousness. In other words, it was just natural and spontaneous, and we would just talk about things that inspired the creative process and about their work.
I was just going to say, did any of them talk to you afterwards about whether it had any effect on the way they were doing their research or perhaps gave them a new perspective on their work?
Well, the interesting thing is I asked each one to write about their experience. To talk about, firstly, their individuated creative process, how they thought they made discoveries creatively. Perimeter loved this because they thought that it would be so interesting for new students or people interested in getting into physics to see what kind of creative process these giants of physics would actually go through. It was like an interesting educational and an inspirational way of reaching out to future scientists. So they did. Each one wrote out their description of how they solved their own creative problems, and then also how the interaction affected them working together with another person, because almost all of them, with a few exceptions, had never had their portrait done, let alone did they ever collaborate or co-create with joint attention a portrait. I've given an example of one person, I'm not going to mention their name, but I asked them, how do you make your discoveries? And this person said, I never thought about it, ever, how I actually made my discoveries, and maybe I don't even make discoveries. I don't have, you know. And I said, well, would you write something? Just write that then, you know, write whatever you really think. And so a week later, I get a couple of paragraphs from this particular person who wrote the most incredibly creative explanation of his own creative process, who said he knew nothing about it and didn't even think he was that creative. And it was amazing what had happened between his awareness, his conscious awareness. I mean, it's all in there, as you know, when you're making your discoveries. But to actually be able to pull all the pieces of this puzzle together about what it is that has inspired you through your life to make these discoveries, and then to be able to relay that or communicate that to others, including yourself, because you're learning about yourself as you're doing it, gives you a tremendous fundamental base to expand on or to expand from. And that's what I kept seeing, that people were taking risks that they hadn't taken before.
So one last question to kind of throw to all of you, and it's almost a shame, I should say, that Ian Durham has also sneaked away while we were talking because he also had other engagements. But, you know, you've all talked about how, you know, this creative side kind of complements and enhances the science side. And Stefan, you're obviously a teacher as well, teaching your students. Have any of you got any thoughts about whether we should change the way that we teach physics and science to students? Is that something we can do? Is that something we should do? Jane is grabbing the mic from me.
I would like to respond to that because, I mean, Yakir and I have been in a dialogue, Yakir Aronoff, about creativity for about 25 years. He always said repeatedly over and over again that physics is taught all wrong and it has to be taught intuitively. And he felt that would be the way that we could create new physics. And he felt that it was essential in order to create new physics that people could do this and be able, again, to make mistakes, be able to fail in order to succeed. And I was trained that way as an artist. The teacher I had never taught techniques. I never learned any technical skills or formulas in drawing. It always came directly, intuitively, direct observation, direct expression, and the style evolved naturally through participation. It was a natural discovery, the hand, the mind, and the mind and the eye, because no formulas exist in the innocent self. Heisenberg would say there's no pre-existing reality. And that's how we started to create something out of this vast nothing of infinite possibilities. So everything was new. Every time we created, there was a perpetual newness that would be spontaneous, unique, very authentic, and then you were creating a living science or a living art that had an ongoing process of emergence.
I can see Stefan nodding here, and obviously this chimes with what you were saying earlier about how you're also trying to encourage your students, I guess your undergraduates, maybe your graduate students, to make mistakes. But, you know, you were sort of talking earlier about what you're doing on a kind of a one-to-one level or as a professor in the classroom. But, you know, is there something we can do on a larger scale? Is there some way that we can think about how to bring these ideas to students at a much younger age? I mean, is that something you've thought about?
I've thought about it, but I've also run I directed a program both at when I was at Dartmouth College for a number of years and now at Brown, which is about an institutional investment in, they're putting resources, literally, as we speak now, in exploring these other modes of training young scientists. So yeah, there is a piece that has to do with like K-12, and of course there's the undergraduate piece, and there's a graduate piece when we talk about, you know, students that do want to go on to become professional scientists. So the results I've seen over the last 4 years is that when you start integrating the conversation, so the very important thing is that we are social beings. That's the first thing we need to recognize. Well, we don't recognize, but it's often like scientists, sometimes forget that and have a hard time not recognizing. And artists as well, too. We get stuck in our own heads. One thing I've observed is that some students are, you know, they're really bright, but they're scared to sort of express themselves in a certain way, because in, at least in physics, you need to actually, you know, you need to learn some calculus, right? So there, in jazz, you need to know your scales before you actually play. So there is a balance, okay, of accreditation, for lack of a better word. But there's also, combined with that, right, this ability to collaborate. But it's very hard to collaborate when students who are not traditional, who are coming from non-traditional backgrounds, be it if you're first generation, if you're a person of color, if you're a woman, right? There are all these people who, in certain fields of science, okay? Or if you're a different type of personality, maybe you're more of an artsy type of person. You don't act like a scientist, right? These things I've discovered, right, are these hidden variables that if you free it up a bit in an institutional setting, okay? And there are ways to do that. One way to do that is that we would have very informal receptions where we'd bring students together of all different sorts. And it would actually be about, like, you know, people just freely talking about how they came up with an idea, and it will usually involve what have you. Another thing that I would do when I teach like intro physics classes, it would be about me deliberately making mistakes on the blackboard. So I'd literally like in deriving something, I would deliberately make a mistake, and then some student would catch the mistake, and then I would say, oh, exactly. So how do we unravel ourselves from this mistake? All right. So again, there are practices that are being explored, and there are good results. One example, I had a student who came in, freshman year, is a C average student, graduates with a Rhodes Scholar, you know, as a Rhodes Scholar, computational neuroscience. So, you know, these diamonds in the rough, and when you expand the, you know, the sort of institutional culture, if we're talking about in the context of universities, right, expand that to be more, I hate to use this word, but more inclusive, stylistically, culturally. When I say culture, I'm talking about expanding our notion of what it means to be in a scientific culture. We just start seeing some interesting things unfurl.
I love what Stefan just said.
Sorry, I should just say, I've already apologized because you left the conversation. So I should say that Ian Durham has now returned to the conversation.
And I'm wearing a swimsuit. I'm going to the hot springs, but you can edit that part out. What Stefan just said is just fantastic. The reason I came back is because I wanted to talk about failure and the importance of failure, and here it is 10 minutes later, you're still talking about it. And the institutional thing, what you just said, is so important. And one of the things that frustrates me about modern academia is how it's become consumer-driven, but the problem is it's not the kids who are really the consumers, it's the parents. And the expectations that the parents and put on them. And then the administration takes those expectations and assumes, well, if we don't cater to that, we're not going to have money, we're not going to get money, and we need money to be here. And so it's sort of this self-perpetuating thing, and it's very frustrating because I think we could really do so much more with so many more students and so much, we could have such a broader representation of students in physics and stuff if there wasn't this intense desire to think in a very specific way. And people want to quantify everything. They want to put numbers to everything. And they think that physics is all about that, too. And it's not. I mean, you know, there are days I never see a number. You know, equations don't necessarily have numbers in them. So I just think it's so important that we not do that, that we allow for more creative ways of thinking and of teaching, and that we make failure part, and I try to do that. I do similar things to what Stefan does, and I have students go up in my quantum course. They have to go up and they have to present problems on the board. I don't even lecture. They go up and they present problems on the board, and then they critique each other. And that idea that you have to make mistakes, and I think unfortunately within the physics community sometimes we're not as accepting of that as well. And again, we have to tread a fine line between there are some genuine cranks out there. A lot of genuine cranks out there. We have to tread that line carefully, but I think there is a lot of legitimate ideas that maybe sometimes get squashed because, yeah, they might have a mistake. And the famous example was the paper by Nick Herbert that Asher Perez allowed to get through to be published in Foundations of Physics, even though he knew it had a mistake, because he knew it was wrong. But he knew that mistake would lead to important results. And it did. And there's not enough of that, I think, sometimes. There's not enough of that.
When I was working with Andrew Briggs, who was one of the subjects that was at Perimeter, we started to talk about his film on the Chevet Caves, which was the cave that was recently discovered maybe about 5 or 6 years ago in France, and where Werner Herzog made a documentary on it, and it's where the first modern artist, he claims the first modern soul or modern artist evolved out of these caves where they had absolutely no trace of a pre-existing culture, any influence from a pre-existing culture. So there, it's like 36,000 to 40,000 years ago, these artists were very individualized like modern artists. And if you've seen the drawings, the sophistication of these drawings of animals in the cave, Picasso would have done anything to be able to draw that innocently. Such an incredible way of vision of seeing. But starting from the beginning, I feel that as artists, we've gone through all of art history. It's sort of like physicists building on other works of physics in the past, the mathematics, but these people created incredible images without any information. They were the beginning, and it was the most astounding, beautiful, and sophisticated work that I've seen in art history. So maybe that's, in a way, maybe we have to start all over again, knowing nothing and making these new discoveries.
I guess the good thing is that Brendan and I really do know nothing about making podcasts, and we fail quite a lot in the process. So that should hopefully mean that this makes for a good addition.
Yeah, it has been great. Thank you, everyone, for coming. Stefan Alexander, Jane Tollickson, Ian Durham, Neil Stevenson, and Zia Morali.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you to my co-host Brendan Foster, signing off there. On the website, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast, we'll have links to purchase Neil Stevenson's books, including Seven Eves, and Stefan Alexander's The Jazz of Physics, published by Basic Books. We'll also have more information about Jane Tollickson's physics art project at the Perimeter Institute. During the conversation, Jane Tollickson mentions some of the physics research carried out by her husband, Jeff Tollickson, on pigeonhole theory, a weird quantum effect. And there will also be a link to a podcast interview with Jeff Tollickson about that on the site. And, of course, Ian Durham is a regular contributor to the podcast, and you can check out some of his end-of-year podcast roundups on the site too, as well as his blog posts from the FQXI meeting. As always, you can contact us at FQXI on Twitter, or you can email us at podcast@fqxi.org. Thank you for listening. I've been Zia Morali.